I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. According to a 2012 survey by the Pew Research Center's Forum on Religion and Public Life, the number of Americans who do not identify with any religion continues to grow at a rapid pace. One-fifth of the U.S. public and a third of adults under 30 are religiously unaffiliated, the highest percentages ever in Pew Research Center polling. Yet of our country's 46 million adults who don't identify with specific religion, more than half say they often feel a deep connection with nature and the earth, while more than a third classify themselves as spiritual but not religious. How we nurture ourselves spiritually varies from individual to individual, but as the Pew poll indicates, there are some commonalities. Today we discuss finding spirituality in everyday life and in unexpected places and explore the place of religion in issues of social justice. And joining us in Woods Hole is Deborah Warner, who's the minister at the Church of the Messiah in Woods Hole. Good morning.
Good morning.
Karen Breitman, who is the rabbi at the Martha's Vineyard Hebrew Center. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ann Fox, minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairhaven.
Good morning.
And Bruce Epperly, pastor at the South Congregational Church in Centerville.
Good morning. Delight to be here.
So many people, regardless of religious affiliation, find themselves marveling at the natural world. I think we all do it, whether it's something that's unexpected, beautiful, or complex. So why do you think there's such a strong connection between spirituality and the natural world?
Well, beauty is the obvious thing that comes to me. And I think so many of our ancient religions, the more ancient religions, really all of their metaphors were nature metaphors. And somebody who's close to my heart, Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of the transcendentalists, I think that they brought it to us massively into our spirituality. Mm-hmm. And I actually have a little quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He says, "These roses under my window make no reference to former roses or to better ones. They are for what they are. They exist with God today. There's no time for them. There is simply the rose. It is perfect in every moment of its existence. We cannot be happy or strong until we too live with nature in the present above time."
That's beautiful.
Well, I think the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead once stated that the aim of the universe is at the production of beauty. And, of course, in the biblical tradition, we have the psalmist saying, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the whole earth is full of God's glory," says Isaiah in the temple. And Jesus enjoyed the lilies of the field. So I think beauty is a spiritual experience grounded in reality, that the world is not just matter in motion or dead and insentient, but is alive and has meaning and purpose and can reveal to us the holy whenever we open our eyes.
Yes, I think that spirituality is a lot about connection and transcending our own egos and experience and feeling that there's a connection between us and the stars and the universe and other sentient beings. And nature helps us get out of our head and feel that connection.
So true. All right, so we often find religious or spiritual inspiration in non-religious texts, literature, poetry. A line or our concept resonates or suddenly gives us a new perspective. So what are some of the passages or works that resonated with you? I know you all brought something. Who wants to start?
Yeah, I'll start. This is a poem by Mary Oliver, and it actually is a nice link to what you were just saying, Mindy. Some questions you might ask. It's from her book, The House of Light. "Is the soul solid like iron, or is it tender and breakable, like the wings of a moth in the beak of an owl? Who has it and who doesn't? I keep looking around me. The face of the moose is as sad as the face of Jesus. The swan opens her white wings slowly. In the fall, the black bear carries leaves into the darkness. One question leads to another. Does it have a shape, like an iceberg, like the eye of a hummingbird? Does it have one lung, like a snake or the scallop? Why should I have it and not the anteater who loves her children? Why should I have it and not the camel? Come to think of it, what about the maple trees? What about the blue iris? What about all those little stones sitting alone in the moonlight? What about roses and lemons and their shining leaves? What about the grass?"
That's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I love thinking about literature and religion because I think that, well, for us, we're people of the book, and the Jewish Bible is filled with so many different genres and things that we may think of as secular, but literature really brings the secular and religious together, crosses that divide. So on Purim, this week in the Jewish calendar, we read the Book of Esther, which is really a farce, and it's humorous, and God's name isn't even in the book. And there's erotic poetry in the Song of Songs. There's great drama in the stories of David. So for me, all literature is game for spirituality. I love the poetry of Dickinson, who talks about, well, God as the syllableless sea, or Stevens, Wallace Stevens, the veritable ocean. But I think one of my favorite books for bridging that religious secular divide is Moby Dick. And so I brought a passage where Ishmael, he has a long description about the white whale, and very physical, very concrete, even boring. And then he goes ahead and says, "Is it not curious that so vast a being as the whale should see the world through so small an eye, and hear the thunder through an ear which is smaller than a hare's? But if his eyes were broad as the lens of Herschel's great telescope, and his ears capacious as the porches of cathedrals, would that make him any longer of sight or sharper of hearing? Not at all. Why, then, do you try to enlarge your mind, subtilize it?" And I love thinking about religion as that way of subtilizing things, really see the deep through very small things that that literature talks about in our everyday life, whether through poetry or a story or narrative.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Well, there's something that about the Tao Te Ching, that's the philosophical text of the Taoist. And when I heard the word Tao, it sort of spoke so directly to my being that I was delighted to read of how it's just has such a strong connection with nature and is likened to nature. And in chapter 8 of the Tao Te Ching, we read, "The highest good is like water. Water gives life to the 10,000 things and does not strive. It flows in places men reject, and so is like the Tao. In dwelling, be close to the land. In meditation, go deep in the heart. In dealing with others, be gentle and kind. In speech, be true. In ruling, be just. In daily life, be competent. In action, be aware of the time and the season. No fight, no blame."
That's beautiful. Bruce, what did you
think? I think Meister Eckhart makes the comment that all things are words of God. Everything speaks forth God. And recently I've been reading a lot of Job for a study we're doing over at South Congregational. And I think about the voice of God in the whirlwind speaking in everything from a leviathan to a hippopotamus to an ostrich to the winds. But I also find the holy in literature of music. One of my favorite songs is by a songwriter I know who I've worked with, Carrie Newcomer. And she writes a song called "Holy as a Day is Spent," "Holy as a Day is Spent," in which she relates the average day of she's living, of making breakfast, the eggs and putting salt on them, of seeing a dog running in its sleep, of the cars going by and making all sorts of noise, of the checkout girl. And she uses a comment that then brings us back to the human animals, us, the empty page, the open book, redemption everywhere I look. As a writer and as a preacher, I appreciate that as I'm working on a book almost every morning I write. And the empty page, the open book, redemption everywhere I look, which means the revelation's coming through us too, as well as through the spotted owl, as well as through the leviathan, as well as through the flowing rivers of the Tao.
So contemplating a society, a world, a universe, something larger than ourselves, that's pretty much the core of religion, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's reflection, probing deeper. So is this spirituality cerebral, or is that only a part of a larger definition?
I think spirituality encompasses the whole of our lives. Again, from our economic lives to our care for our children and other people's children, to looking out at the vistas on Grand Canyon, or gazing across from Woods Hole to Martha's Vineyard and pondering that. So I think the spirituality really encompasses us where we are. There's a phrase I happen to like. No one exactly knows who the author. It's attributed to many. God is a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. So the center is everywhere. It's right where we are. But it includes everything in this 14-billion-year cosmic journey and the Earth journey and galaxies we'll never encounter.
Yeah, I think spirituality also is about unity, mm-hmm. and that includes unity of our being, you know, our mind, our body, and our heart. And I think we get stuck when we separate those things, especially in our churches and synagogues.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I just think it's also about it's about opening our heart to the whole of creation as well, and that's as well as our intellect. But it's allowing ourselves to slow down, to listen, to watch, to see, to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which, in terms of our time, I mean, part of it is, in terms of spirituality, is also allowing ourselves to slow down into time.
Mm. What are your thoughts on, we started the program talking about some of this Pew Research Center's polling, and interesting that a lot of these people who have no religious affiliation say they are very spiritual. So I wonder your thoughts on the differences. Do you see spirituality and religion is the same thing? I mean, or are they completely different?
I think they're interdependent. Because, of course, there's another category besides the spiritual but not religious. It's the spiritual and religious,
mm-hmm, right,
which is what we aspire toward in our congregations, Christian, Jewish, and others, is that we encompass both a lived experience of the holy, of God, however we experience the Spirit in our lives. We also are part of institutions that endure over time. And institutions can be deadly, and they can be full of life. And many of the greatest works of art and music, literature, have come out of organizations that sustain themselves over time. So I think both and. You know, there is a bias against institutions these days, but at least I suspect the goal of everyone around this circle is that our institutions be both spiritual and religious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Anne.
I'm actually encouraged to hear that so many young people are saying that they are spiritual, because to me, I think of God as spirit. Mm-hmm. And so just the fact that they're bandying around the word spirit probably says to that something about that generation, that I think they are actually feeling the spirit more than other generations have allowed themselves. They thought that God was in the temple, God was in the church. But I think that it might be good for more of us to think about that saying that we are not human beings trying to be spiritual. We are spiritual beings trying to be human. Mm. So I think that they are tuning in to that spiritual self, and gives me great encouragement. Of course, I wish that they'd come to the church, because what they would find in church or synagogue or mosque is that shared spirituality is so much more powerful when we speak together, when we sing together, when we touch together. Or it's a very powerful experience. You don't really get that by yourself.
But it also is a way of to having people from outside come in, of bringing to life the people who are within too, in terms of the community too. I think that one of the refreshing things that I've seen, and certainly in the Episcopal Church, has been as the church has gone outside of its walls. In the Diocese of Massachusetts, we have something called the Common Cathedral, which is a ministry to the homeless in Boston on the Boston Common. And that has brought a level of honesty to the church, I think. Mm-hmm. And instead of just simply having the church people come into the religious building or the religious community, to have the community go out, but to be with the community where the community is, as opposed to it has to come, you have to come in this particular way.
Mm-hmm. I experience religion and spirituality as one, though I welcome the critique that splitting them implies, that maybe our religions and institutions aren't focused on spirituality. And I think that's an old, important critique. The prophets did that as well. The prophets said, Isaiah said, if you just focus on sacrifice and not on social justice, what's that? It's meaningless. So mm-hmm. I think that contemporary critique is true as well. So it keeps us honest. And for me, I share what you said, Anne, that being in community, having a commitment to a tradition that I grow to know more and more over time, having a sense of belonging to something more than individual, going through life together, those are very powerful things. I couldn't replicate what my tradition teaches me or what I grow to understand in my tradition just by myself.
Yeah. We're discussing spirituality and religion. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about spirituality in everyday life. And with us is Anne Fox, who's a minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairhaven, Bruce Epperly, pastor at the South Congregational Church in Centerville, Deborah Warner, minister at the Church of Messiah in Woods Hole, and Karen Breitman, who's the rabbi at the Martha's Vineyard Hebrew Center. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So religious texts are certainly a source of inspiration and teaching, but let's talk about their interpretation. I think of a document like the U.S. Constitution written just over 200 years ago, and we debate the founding fathers' meaning. So what about documents as old as the Bible and the Torah? What are the approaches we use to understanding their meaning?
Well, I think that the scriptures are living documents, and that in many ways the point of scripture is to be an adventure story that invites us to be participants. I think we need to read the scripture with our whole self in the 21st century, as well as in the spirit of those who brought them to life over many centuries. So from my perspective, for example, in a week or so, we're talking about Genesis, or this past week we had the story of Adam and Eve. And these are not probably literal stories of literal people. The author of Genesis, probably Genesis 1, the creation story, the first one, or two of them at least, was probably not trying to give us science, but to give us the broad perspective of where the universe finds itself and where we find ourselves. And I don't think we need to separate scripture from science. I don't think we need to assume that the words are exactly as we see them in terms of the experiences of folk. I use an example of the healing stories of Jesus. I'm a student of the healings of Jesus and just did a seminar on the healings of Jesus at our church. And a woman is cured of a flow of blood in 100 words. Driving from Centerville here, I could take a journal and do a couple thousand words. The stories are always more than what we see on paper, and sometimes the blank whiteness of the paper invites us to use our imagination and place ourselves in the story. I'd like to know what happened to that woman the day after the healing.
In Judaism, reading and interpreting texts is the central religious act, and there's a word called midrash that we interpret text that comes from the word to seek or to search, and that acting of seeking and searching through multiple meanings and interpretations of text is really central. So in Midrash collections, you would have an interpretation of something in the text, and then you would have another idea, and just lists of 10 different that are mutually exclusive, but there's just so much joy in giving different interpretations. And the Talmud says in Hebrew, Elu ve'elu dvarim chayim, that Elohim, that both these and these are words of the living God.
Anybody else want to jump in there?
Well, we use often in our church Lectio Divina, or holy reading, where you take an imaginative reading of a text. And I do that almost in every Bible study. And there's usually, if there's 12 people, there's 12 foci. Mm. And that's especially helpful in dealing with ethical issues about lifestyle, about sexual orientation, and other things where people can hold the democracy of the Spirit and have different interpretations and say, this is how the Spirit speaks to me today.
Mm. So, go ahead. Did you?
Well, I think that just stories, well, from all kinds of religion, and I was just reading a story that the Buddha told about a man who was from the lowest caste, and he would go through, he was not allowed to be in society, but he would go through what society had tossed out, and he was going through the garlands of flowers to find something that he could sell that was in good enough shape. And the Buddha walked over to him, and he hid his face, thinking that he was not worthy to look into a great person's face. And the Buddha made him look at him, and he saw immediately in him his goodness, and in fact that he was an enlightened person, although he was a lowly person. And I thought to myself, you know, this is a story about seeing, well, of many things, but seeing in all people that divinity and that goodness and that wholeness. And that man, actually, he elevated him in his ashram. So I think even stories that you hear on the news really grab your heart. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that spirituality, if we're looking for connectedness, and it's everywhere. Mm.
You know, Karen, what you were just saying about interpreting and that, you know, continuing kind of leads into this next question, is how we apply the words and teachings of these old documents into issues today, such as immigration, economic justice, healthcare, the environment. Mm. So how do we do that?
Well, in the Jewish Bible, it's really central. One of the most common lines in the Bible is to love the stranger as yourself. Do not oppress the stranger, because you were strangers in Egypt. That sense that of empathy. We know what it's like to be oppressed. The whole Jewish people in the Torah came to being through an act of a political act of going from slavery to freedom. So there's so much in the Torah about that we can apply today, not wronging the stranger. We could apply that to immigration or to anybody that looks different from the people in power. The Torah also says there's one law for you and the stranger. And that's something our criminal justice system is really struggling with, making sure there's one law for everyone, no matter what they look like, no matter what their race. Right now, people, young black men get put in jail for things that young white men would never or very rarely get put in jail for. So that's another thing. God says clearly that he's on the side of the oppressed. And the Torah talks about redistribution of wealth through the sabbatical year, for example, or the seventh year when debts will be forgiven. And our laws of debt have been made more oppressive in the past 15 years. And I think most important is there's a sense that when there are poor in the society, it's the responsibility of the society. That's really clear in the Torah. It's all of our responsibility to help everyone in our society not be poor. It's not it's not about individual responsibility. It reflects on us as a society.
Hmm. Anybody else want to?
Well, in terms of in the Book of Acts, the New Testament, the Christian scriptures, there's a sense of people holding things in common. Mm-hmm. And what would that be if we held things in common? Instead of having an increasing disparity between those the rich and the poor, or Tavis Smiley and Cornel West say in the title of the book, "The Rich and the Rest of Us."
Well, I think that the Hebraic Christian tradition might take seriously, and certainly we do as Christians, the words of Rabbi Heschel of the divine pathos, that God experiences the world in which we live. And a different kind of world shapes God's experience in different ways and opens up new possibilities for God. So the divine pathos in talking about the prophets, and Jesus was part of this lineage of one who saw himself in this tradition, everything matters. The scales matter.
Yeah.
Whether the rent is paid matters. The children getting adequate and safe schools and housing matters. Everything matters because it matters to God, and certainly it matters to God in the sense that it shapes God's experience. God really does hear the cries of the poor, and more than that, experiences them. That's what I think Christians mean. What we mean by the incarnation is that the Word made flesh means God experiences this world, and it's not planned in advance, but it's experienced in the now. Do we want to give God a good world or a bad one, a beautiful one or an ugly one?
Anne? Yes, I believe that all of our religions call us to share our wealth. I rather like the idea of tithing, not just to give 10% to the church, but to give 10% of your wealth. And I think that's a good guideline for everyone. Imagine if we all went, and even our most wealthiest people in the world, if they would every year give 10% of their wealth. And some of them, of course, do. But not enough. And so I think there's even a statistics show us that poor people tend to give more than wealthier people. But so the Bible gives us that guideline of that 10%. So I think that the Bible was very much, not just the Bible, but the Quran as well, very much counsels us to share and to take care of others and right. That's what it's about.
So many of these social issues are political issues. So what role do you think religion should have in the political process?
A big role.
Yes, I agree.
Well, it's a pity that, we all have a conflict with separation of church and state. We do want the state to be separated from the church, but we want the state to be counseled more by the church. I believe that we're set up, our world is set up with government and churches, and the government has most of the power. And so I think it's incumbent upon our churches and temples and the religions to call our governments to account when they're wrong. And it pains me that we are the only Western democracy that doesn't care for its people, doesn't have a health system that is a national health system, for example. That's caring for your people.
Yeah. Right. I obviously think that there should be a complete separation of church and state, and that's one of the wonderful things about our democracy. But I also think that as citizens, we need to bring our values to the table. And a lot of us are inspired by our religious values, and I think more people can be if they see the way our traditions talk about justice. And if you think about Martin Luther King, it would be hard to imagine the civil rights movement without his faith and the inspiration that he took from the prophets, from Amos and Moses, and the idea that God's on the side of the oppressed.
I agree. However, I also get very nervous when certain faith traditions, particularly evangelical Christians who are reading in a very literal way the religious texts and are trying to, in terms of, for instance, women's health care, and take away the right of women to be seen as whole human beings and deserve to be seen that way and to have to be reading certain, and you can go to it in terms of the New Testament. There are certain texts, you know, wives, obey your husband. And, you know, if the husband says, you know, this is what's going to be, this is the way it's going to be. And I have, when that sense of is that kind of perspective is emphasized in the political realm out, that grows out of a strong religious tradition, it makes me extremely uncomfortable and wary and weary too.
Yes. I think that the religious journey involves inspiring the moral imagination of people. To think imaginatively, not just about their own lives, but the broader society. And so, for example, in the Christian church, we're in the season of Lent. And Lent has all sorts of political implications. It may not be the politics of left or right or red or blue, but during Lenten season, we remember our temptations, our sin, which is, can be defined in a whole bunch of different ways, but at least how far governments and persons go from God's vision of shalom, of wholeness, of peace, and are called to notice the difference between where we are and where we could be as people. And I think that the religious imagination invites us to start where we are. Let's look at our local schools or our local housing with Habitat for Humanity, and then look beyond that to other people's children and other people's housing, and assume that we have to address that. And there are many ways to address it, but we have to address it.
We're talking about religion with area religious leaders. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk about science and religion after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about spirituality in everyday life. And with us is Ann Fox, who's a minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairhaven, Bruce Epperly, pastor at the South Congregational Church in Centerville, Deborah Warner, minister at the Church of Messiah in Woods Hole, and Karen Breitman, who is the rabbi at the Martha's Vineyard Hebrew Center. And before we move on to our conversation of religion and science, Karen, you wanted to follow up on something that we said in the last segment.
Yeah, I think as long as we honor our constitutional guarantees about separation of church and state and not having an established religion, I want everyone to be able to bring their inspirations to the table, including evangelicals or people, you know, who are more conservative than I do on certain issues. First, I think that we will be able to find things in common on the environment, for example, creation care. We have a lot in common about that. This is God's creation, and I think we can work together in that. I think that things would come up if we had a real discussion. So, for example, like abortion. I don't think that abortion is in the New Testament and in the Hebrew Bible. It does say that if a woman is pushed and the fetus dies and she's safe, there's a fine, which means that there's not, that fetus is not understood as a full human being. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy, but it's not the same thing. That conception does not, that birth does not start at conception. And we could have those discussions. A lot of religions don't see birth at a full human being at conception, but I'd like to have those discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anne?
Well, I think that I'd love to have our listeners consider that being part of a religious community, not only is do you have that feeling of religious power together, the spiritual power, but also in acting together, we can bring about great change. And Karen was talking about how Martin Luther King Jr. was the voice that called people together from all parts of the country for that change. But I think that for marriage equality, many churches were working for marriage equality and were helpful in getting that voice out there and to bring that change about. And we can do the same with income inequality as well. And churches can get out there on the streets. And we probably need to do that. That's the next thing that we have to do, is to band together and go to Washington and have a 6 million person gathering. And so I think that, yes, that's what the prophets called us to do. And I think that's what we must do.
I just want to, again, I want to pick up also what Karen just said, also with the sense of the fullness, when we get into the discussion in terms of
a person being a full human being at the moment of conception. But people don't then, once the child is born, they don't treat the child with the sense of the fullness of mm-hmm. being a person. Mm-hmm. If they are born in a poor community, or they're African American and they're a boy and they're, you know, walking down the street, they are looked at with a certain level of suspicion. I mean, there are ways at which there's not a consistency, I suppose, mm-hmm. is what that sense of trying to see the to continue the that perspective or argument. Mm-hmm. Is very important, I think.
And at our best, we are places where people can have the conversation in meaningful ways. The political sphere often is a sphere of sound bites and tends to look for crossfire or firing lines, very militaristic approaches to diversity. And if you disagree on one thing, agree on 100, that one thing is going to keep us from being friends mm-hmm. and political allies. There is common ground in the scripture tradition to give us our marching orders or our walking orders, and we need safe conversations where we can sit and talk about where we're coming from without demonizing one another, and find the common ground, perhaps on the mm-hmm. environment, yeah. perhaps on reducing the circumstances that lead to unplanned pregnancies, to look at ways that beyond left and right we can find the hungry are fed, that children are educated, that the moment of birth becomes a moment of joy mm-hmm. for all children.
I think in the abortion issue, people often talk past each other. Mm-hmm. So you have some people talking from their religious language, and then you have liberal secular people talking about choice, which is not the same conversation. And it's possible that if we really put our religious beliefs on the table, that people who are religious who are in favor of abortion rights could maybe have some common language, so at least we could understand each other.
Yes. Right. Let's talk to mm-hmm. Kevin, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, Kevin.
Oh, good morning. It's my understanding that all of the major religious organizations in the United States, except Southern Baptist, opposed the shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003. But it happened anyway, and I wonder if that's, you know, bothers anyone that considered okay. something that...
You know, frankly, I think we were blindsided by that invasion of Iraq. I mean, when we heard about the invasion, we thought, what? What? Don't they mean Afghanistan? And I think that it took us a while to really get our minds around that this was actually happening. And I would take the press to task for this, because I know that in the New Bedford area, we had a peace rally which was not covered. I think that the press, to be kind, I mean, really, these are wonderful people who take a lot of chances. But I think that there was the feeling of patriotism and that it wasn't patriotic to oppose that. But there were many of us who opposed it, but no one was listening. You know, you depend on the press to get the word out that there's a different voice out there.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks for the call. All right, so let's talk about religion and science. On the surface, the relationship between the two would seem paradoxical, but there can be some common ground. As we've been talking about other things, there's always common ground. So let's start with an issue that often pits science against religion, which is evolution. The majority of scientists accept Darwin's theory of evolution, but according to that Pew Research poll, only 32% of American public embraces Darwin's theories. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a very interesting point, and some of it, I think, is through failure of nerve at the pulpit, to be honest with you. We can, from the pulpit, invite people to imagine different ways of living. We talked about evolution a bit in the mm-hmm. pulpit this week in terms of Adam and Eve and their role in the fall upward, you might say, as well as the fall downward. After all, they probably weren't historical characters living 7,000 years ago, but they are every woman and every man. I think people, again, going back to the language issues, we've not done a good job in our churches of educating people about the grandeur of the universe, about inviting them to watch cosmos, the new cosmos, to see that this is a grand universe. The author of Genesis had no interest nor knowledge of Darwin or quantum theory or the 13-point billion-year age of the universe or 125 billion galaxies in the universe. That wasn't his or her business. It was to paint a picture of a world that had meaning and purpose, beauty and wonder, of which humankind found a home. So at one level, once we get beyond the literalism and to the midrash, as you might say, which gives us all sorts of possible answers, we may not, as religious people, be able to provide religious information, but we may provide a perspective for understanding.
Well, I can give a nice example of a midrash. When you look at the two creation stories, as you said, they're different. So since they're completely different and they can't both be right, it probably means that that wasn't the point of including those stories to give you a how-to scientific of what happened, but more what does it mean for us? And so one midrash about Adam asks, why does humanity flow from one person? And the answer is, not an argument that evolution is wrong and this is right. The answer is to teach us that if we kill or hurt one human being, it's like destroying the whole universe, because the whole universe is in each and every human being. So for us, those creation stories is about, you know, it's about understanding ourselves and it's about morality.
So we have a similar divide between some religious organizations and the scientific community on the issue of federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. But unlike the divide on evolution, which revolves around questions of fact, the division on embryonic stem cell research is largely driven by moral questions, including disputes over, as you mentioned earlier, the status of embryos. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that anything that promotes healing in the long run, we should affirm. The status of embryos, I happen to believe that life begins 14 billion years ago. So for me, fetuses are alive. That's no question about it. And they have moral consideration needs to be given to them. Having said that, all ethics is a matter of balancing rights. Fetuses have rights. Women have rights. And balancing them. I don't think there is an absolute sanctity of life in Scripture. There's a lot of war-making in Scripture, so life is not the highest value, or Jesus wouldn't have gone to the cross, you might say. But it's how we live our lives. It's the quality of life. It's the godliness of life. It seems to me that if we can find ways to help people through any sort of way that is not ultimately destructive of the value of life and the beauty of life, we should do it.
A thought that came to my mind was how relieved I felt to hear that stem cells were being gotten through means other than through fetuses, because I suspect that departments of ethics in hospitals were probably created to have a balance between what science would like to go straight to do and what is a human condition situation. And that was my feeling, that I think we do need to have some breaks on science. Mm-hmm. But I personally don't have a conflict between science and religion. And I think a lot of people nowadays really, really do not. Mm-hmm. The vastness of the universe, when I think of the cosmos, the original cosmos, I mean, what was more inspiringly spiritual than the billions and billions and billions
yes,
stars.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, Albert Einstein once said that science without religion is lame and religion without science is blind.
I mean, the wonder of the universe is chock full. The scriptures are chock full of stories of the wonder of the universe. And I think the awe is the issue. And the awe about fetuses, the awe about elders dying, And that we're always on holy ground, that there's burning bushes everywhere, and we best take a care to preserve beauty and experience and life in all its forms, knowing, again, as Whitehead said, life is robbery. There's death in the world, too.
Yeah. All right, let's talk to Dana, who's giving us a call from Wellfleet. Good morning, Dana.
Hello, good morning. Thank you. I was the evangelical fundamentalist Christian in different stripes for about 30 years. And now these days I'm an agnostic, and the only reason I am is maybe my view of God is archaic. And I don't expect everything to be airy-fairy, you know, big kumbaya around the campfire, but I just can't understand how an all-loving and omniscient, omnipotent God would allow the innocent to suffer at the hands of the guilty. I mean, it's one thing if I don't look after myself and I suffer, if I don't take responsibility for myself, that's one thing. But when, you know, I hear about, you know, innocent children starving in Africa, or, you know, Syrian children, victims of war, or animals, you know, suffering at the hands of humans unnecessarily, like for circuses, or, you know.
Dana is bringing up a really good point. There are a lot of people, I think, who share Dana's viewpoint. What do you think?
Well, I think it falls into the category that God does this, that God causes these things, or God can not cause things. God chooses to save some and not choose another. And so we really are talking more about, you know, does God do that? I heard someone say recently, oh, God doesn't allow these things, but God would ask, why do you?
Well, I'll be driving straight back to the church to do a study on Job at noon today on experiencing the holy and suffering. And it's my assumption that just as Job presents us a whole smorgasbord of possibilities, that there's a smorgasbord of theological possibilities. I happen to think that God deals with a universe that involves chaos as well as order, that involves divine intentionality, wanting to have this happen, wanting a better world, and then there's free play. God, there is dice in the universe, contrary to Einstein. There are events that occur that God doesn't will. And there are events that God seeks to help become healing events. But I don't perceive that God is the cause of earthquakes directly or cancer directly. Mm-hmm. But the one who sets all things in motion has a role, but it's not the role of the killer.
Yeah. Dana, thanks for the call. Anne? Yeah, if you have something you want to read there, so
I
you have
do.
The book open.
Oh, well, right. it's a poem by Dana Faulds, and it's called Embrace the World. May light be born anew in me and you. May peace reign within our hearts and gratitude frame our days with gladness and with joy. May each one of us awaken to the truth and allow the universe to use us, hearts, hands, minds, and prayers, united to embrace the world.
I wanted to say that the caller asked a question, as you said, that is, it's really important to ask, and he's really joining a conversation that's been going on for thousands of years, and that has been put in our holy text through Job, and that we need to keep asking those questions, and maybe we've made an idol of a certain idea of God that then breaks and we don't have anything left.
I also think with that is that, as Dana said, I mean, one's own experience of God evolves over the course of one's life, too, I think. It does change. And we ask questions in a different way, and we start looking around and saying things in a different way. And those of us that are part of religious communities and denominations or faith traditions can also ask those questions of the denomination and say, why are we spending millions of dollars on this particular project when to the exclusion of other things, other needs. There's a fair amount of controversy in Boston, in terms of that it's been in the news, in terms of the purchase of a rectory in Trinity, Boston.
And unfortunately, we have to leave it there, but we'll continue this discussion for sure. I want to thank Deborah Warner, minister at the Church of Messiah in Woods Hole, Karen Boitman, rabbi at the Martha's Vineyard Hebrew Center, Ann Fox, minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairhaven, and Bruce Epperly, pastor at the South Congregational Church in Centerville. Always interesting to hear your points of view. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.